Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. A bank bifurcation. Shares of money centers like J.P. Morgan and investment banks like Morgan Stanley moving in vastly different directions since earnings season kicked off. How should you read into the results and what do they say about the state of the market? Plus 34-year lows. Japan's currency trading at levels not seen since New Kids on the Block were topping the charts. Will the yen keep moving lower step by step? And why does it matter? And later, United Health keeps the Dow in the green. LVMH shoppers tighten their purse strings. And Bitcoin makes a break towards 60K. Is it heading even lower from here? I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq on the desk tonight. Carter Worth, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Tim Seymour. We start off with that post-earnings divergence in the big banks, consumer-facing names under pressure. Bank of America among the biggest laggards in the S&P today, dropping 3.5% despite a top and bottom line beat. The money center pinched by higher interest rates, which drove first quarter profit lower. That follows J.P. Morgan, which late last week forecast lower than expected interest income through the end of 2024. Those shares off by more than 7% since reporting on Friday, but it hasn't been all bad news for financials, with investment banks seeing some more strength. Goldman Sachs, of course, one of them. Morgan Stanley today closing 2.5% higher after its biggest earnings beat in 3 years. Wealth management and advisory revenues boosting those results. As we mentioned, Goldman also saw trading investment banking revenue surge. Those shares down today, but still up since its report yesterday. So what are the banks telling us? It's a little bit of a mixed message here, but ultimately there's the results side of it and the stock reaction side of it, which may not necessarily reflect the same story.
Yeah, so it's interesting. Wealth management fees, right? And again, those are balances, and there's also, you know, net interest margin to be earned there. So I think the bifurcation is really interesting, right? So the other money centers that don't have, as far as the exposure, let's say, though, Morgan Stanley, we know that they've spent the last 10 years, diversifying away from just that core investment banking business. So when I look at the performance of Goldman Sachs, I look at the performance of Morgan Stanley, maybe there were, like, not great expectations, if you will, but they did really well. And you could say to yourself, if you see the economy the way at least the market sees the economy, then some of the businesses that they're exposed to should do better in the back half of this year. We know that there was a few IPOs that got the calendar going a little bit. We know that there was some M&A. We also know if the IPO calendar comes back, that there's a dual track, right? There's strategic M&A that should be a part of that. So I see what investors see in Goldman and Morgan. As far as the money centers, okay, they've come a long way. You know, look at the outperformance that JP Morgan had over the last, let's call it, 6 months from the October lows. And if you are in a higher for longer environment, it's just not going to be as good for them.
Well, I think for JP Morgan, it can be good higher for longer. But I think the one of the big disappointments from their earnings call was the expectation of further compression or more compression. The quarter itself was fine, but that's not relevant really anymore. It was about the future of compression on the NIM. So and I think they are also very conservative. But so, you know, fixed income across the board was good. Advisory and wealth management across the board also good. I think, you know, to Dan's point, I like J.P. Morgan as much the day before as I liked it, much lower. But I think there was just expectations too high. Wasn't a crazy multiple or anything, but, you know, it's down one multiple turn now from there because the multiple is pretty low. So I sort of like them across the board. I want to stay in this long, big money center and short carry.
Yeah. And the setup has been your thesis in terms of it was too steep going
into earnings. Right? Citi up 60-some percent off its October. I mean, all stocks have an October low, regardless of sector or type. And then this group up 40-50% certain stocks, whereas Goldman and Morgan Stanley really hadn't done that much. There is, of course, that the investment bank and broker sub-industry group in the S&P has been outperforming the BKX since the 09 low. And yet, it all depends about your time frame. Morgan Stanley right now is $90. You know what it was at the dot-com peak? Mary Meeker and all that stuff? $90. So 24 years later, that's called losing about 60% of your value adjusted for inflation.
Yeah. Tim, what was your take, and how do you factor in, Powell actually spelling out the fact that it will be higher for longer?
Well, first of all, I'm troubled by that we referenced the New Kids on the Block for the first time on Fast Money. So, I know we're hanging tough and we're taking this step by step. But my view on money center banks is that a 10 to 11% move, really by Citi, JP Morgan, Bank of America, all since their peak a couple of days before earnings, is a function of I think Carter's view on things and just where we've come from. I didn't hear anything in JP Morgan's numbers that concerned me. I will say the securities losses are something that I think people will start to pay more attention on now that rates continue to move higher. Karen pointed out that net interest income margins are lower, or they forecasted lower. I think that's disappointing, and Dan and everyone's talked about asset management. In terms of Powell, I'm kind of surprised the market didn't do even more destruction to equities on those comments. I mean, I just feel like not only is the Fed dialed back an overly dovish Fed meeting that I certainly was critical of, I think you have a dynamic here between where, you know, when he's talking about inflation really not giving any ground, that's an inflation that's above their 2% target, a 2% target they haven't hesitated to say is very much still in play. So I thought today's Powell comments were significant, and I think the bond market told you what you wanted. I think you're getting this, call it this bearish flattener, which means that short rates are coming up faster than the long end's going up, even though we're focused on the 10-year. And you know, that's part of where we are. We're reassessing where the short end of the curve is going to be out, not just short term, but maybe even medium term, at least as we get into 25.
Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan just talked about Fed policy and loan growth this afternoon on the closing bell. Here's what he had to say.
Year over year, we're up 1% in loan growth. That's, you know, that's fine, but we expect to see more. If the economy running this strong, you'd expect to see more, but I think it has to do with general borrowing conditions still muted due to, even on home loans, obviously higher mortgage rates slow down the borrowing process there.
So what are we learning about the actual economy, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Jamie Dimon has been telegraphing this, and we've been talking about, like, almost in a split screen, Jamie Dimon versus Brian Moynihan, going back to that kind of situation, a storm is coming and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, Moynihan kind of clapping back at Jamie. And I think what's clear is if you're choosing your fighter, it's Jamie Dimon. And I know you already chose it long ago. But it's interesting, you know, to me, when I just kind of think about JP Morgan's stock and where it was, you know, just a couple months ago, it was at $175. It got to $220. That was...
It got to 200.
JP Morgan?
Yeah.
Okay, 200.
Yeah.
Okay, so 200 down here to 180. So it's down 10% or so. Yes, excuse me. Sorry. So you just think about that. It's just taking out a little bit of the froth. And so when we think about the economy, to answer your question, it's like, okay, so we saw yields in that time period go from like 4.1% to where they are right now. So, you know, a half a percent or so move. The economy, you know, like the outlook for the economy has been actually okay, right? If all the data, and that's part of the problem. That's one of the reasons why yields have moved the way they are. But Jamie Dimon has consistently said, expect rates much higher than here, like, or possibly. And so I think the stuff that he's doing and the cautious optimism that he has about the economy, he's preparing his bank for maybe a more difficult environment, but they'll also execute really well in a good environment too. So I don't know. I'm with you. If this thing comes back to, let's say, 170, I think it's probably like a slam dunk of a buy, especially relative to a lot of its money center peers.
One thing on Bank of America today, there was a tick up of, I mean, it wasn't huge, it wasn't a disaster or anything like that, but just a tick up in credit quality, right? And it's been very, very good for a long time. So, but you wonder, all right, is that the change? And we're heading, you know, the
credit
pendulum.
Quality.
Right.
Or is it, you mean in terms of the FICO scores being higher?
No, in terms of the charge-offs and, yes,
okay. Yeah.
Non-performing loans, right. It's been so good for a long time. You know it can't stay that way forever. The magnitude of this move in itself alone was really not anything concerning. It's just a question of, are we really going to see pendulum swing?
I mean, you know, you were asked about the message that from the banks for the economy. The message from retailers is completely different, isn't it? I mean, we've got that XRT down now almost 12% with this dropping and gapping every day. Another one of the sort of prominent names falls on its earnings results. You know, the higher for longer, it gets down to that, right? Are we really going above 5%? We shall see. But my hunch is that rates are not going much higher.
All right. Former FDIC Chair Sheila Bair joins us now with more on the bank. She's also the CNBC Global Financial Wellness Advisory Board. Sheila, it's always great to see you.
Nice to see you. Thanks for having me.
I understand that you think the big banks are largely in good shape, nothing to worry about here. But even with the economy pretty strong still, you are worried about the regional banks. What do you think is that shoe that's going to drop there?
Well, I think I'm worried about a handful of them. I think some of them are still overly reliant on uninsured deposits, have a lot of concentrated commercial real estate exposure. And then I think the larger picture really is the potential instability of their uninsured deposits, even for the healthy ones, if we have another bank failure. So I do, as I said before, I think Congress should reinstate the FDIC's transaction account guarantee authority so that they can stabilize those deposits. Congress isn't doing much of anything these days, so wait in line. But I do think that this is still a problem for the regional banks, and fingers crossed if there's another failure, we're just quite not sure what's going to happen.
The 10-year yield at 4.6% and some forecasting it to go to, you know, 4.75%, 4.8%. Does that concern about regionals and the exposure to commercial real estate, does that heighten?
Well, yeah, I mean, the higher the rate. So part of the problem with commercial real estate is that a lot of it's refinancing this year and next. So the higher the rates go for those refinancings, the more distress there will be with borrowers to be able to continue with their payments. But with CRE, the commercial real estate, we had this problem during the great financial crisis. There are things you can do. There are workout strategies. You know, some people pejoratively call it extended pretend. You don't want to do that. If, you know, if the borrower's cooked, the borrower's cooked. But a lot of these borrowers can get through with some active workout strategies. So I think I still think it's a slow burn over time. And again, the big issue is whether there's another shock to uninsured deposits because of a bank failure. And I think that is really the biggest challenge confronting regional banks right now.
Hey, Sheila, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. I share your view that the big money center banks are in a very different balance sheet place than some of the regionals. I guess if we're worried about commercial real estate, though, when I think of the sheer size of the CRE market relative to even subprime, we're not even close. We're stratospheres apart in terms of the broader exposure. And this is where I'm not sure people understand. Not you, of course, but the world of everybody who is assessing credit and the potential domino effect from where CRE could go, especially if rates have to go another 100 basis points higher. And in that world, don't the money center banks have exposure to regional banks?
Well, first of all, the money center banks do have their own significant commercial real estate exposure. This is not a concentration for them, so there's less focus on it. But yeah, I mean, I think I have to say, though, I think that their big mega banks benefit from regional banks' distress. Are you suggesting there's going to be some knock-on impact if there's going to be a string of failures with the regional banks? I think it helps them. You know, the business goes there. That's where it goes. They're viewed as too big to fail, rightly or wrongly. I know my former agency, the FDIC, is committed to ending too big to fail and is determined to use the resolution authorities they have if a big bank got into trouble. But the market doesn't believe that. So, no, I think regional bank distress benefits the big money center banks. There's no doubt in my mind.
Sheila, it's Karen. Thanks for being on. A question about Basel III endgame. Two-part question. Do you think it went too far? And how do you think, where do you think it ultimately shakes out?
Well, I think there's some really good things in it. There's some things that are probably not very good and very, very complex and a lot of administrative costs from that unnecessary complexity. I don't think that should be a priority right now. Let those rules primarily respond to, you know, things that we didn't get done after the great financial crisis. They've been 14 years in the making. My view is they can wait a little longer. Liquidity really needs to be front and center. I know the regulators are working on a new package of strategies and proposals to deal with, to provide more liquidity, mainly by getting banks to use the discount window more and be more prepared to use the discount window. So I expect those to be coming out. But I think that should be a higher priority right now than the Basel III endgame. At some point, those will get done. There's a lot of good things in it, but I don't think that should be the priority right now.
Sheila, always great to see you. Thanks.
Yeah, sure. I bet.
Sheila Bair. Well, Fed Chair Powell suggesting today that interest rate cuts could be pushed out even further with inflation still well above target. Let's get to Steve Leisman with all the details here. Steve.
Hey, Melissa, after today's high-level Fed speech from the chair and the vice chair, based both on what they've said and not said, there's a case to be made that the Fed's base case has moved away from cuts likely being appropriate. Fed Chair Jay Powell saying this afternoon in a conversation with the Canadian central banker that the central banks or the Fed's restrictive policy meets further time to work. Here's what else he said. He went on to say he noted a lack of further progress on inflation this year. He said the recent data has not given the Fed greater confidence to cut. 3 months of little progress means that progress has taken longer than expected to achieve the confidence to cut. And the Fed can maintain that restrictive rate as long as is needed. What Powell didn't say may be equally important. Remember, back in earlier this month, he said if the economy evolves broadly as we expect, we see it as likely to be appropriate to begin lowering the policy rate at some point this year. That was not part of his remarks today. Fed Vice Chair Jefferson had used that same language in late February, but he omitted them from prepared remarks today as well, making the case that the base case may not be for cuts anymore. Well, the market beginning to price all of this in. Here are your probabilities. 3% for May. You can write that off. June, increasingly a long shot. July becoming less than an even money proposition for a cut. September is your best case right there, 68%. So 491 is the January 2025 contract compared to the current rate of 538. That still shows slightly less than two cuts built in this year. But remember, that contract had called for six cuts not all that long ago. The market had heard increasingly hawkish talk from other Fed officials, but not necessarily from the leadership like it did today. It remains to be seen if no cuts becomes the base case for equity and bond investors and Wall Street's Fed forecasters, who are going to have to erase some of that eraser in order to change their base case again. None of this means the Fed won't cut at all. It means it's not the default position anymore to preemptively cut rates. And I'm kind of with Tim, Melissa, on the idea that there wasn't more market reaction to that. Maybe they wake up this morning, or maybe they've priced it in already.
That's very true, Steve. I was actually kind of surprised, too, because it seems now if Powell is going to acknowledge that the inflation readings that we've had so far are sort of breaking that previous base case scenario, then it seems like the bar is even higher for them to then go ahead and cut, that the trend has to be reestablished in terms of inflation readings coming down.
Yeah, and let me make a couple of things I want to say. First of all, if you look back to Thursday in the S&P, we're off 2.7 or 3% from there. So the market, maybe not because of the Fed, but because of his concern about Iran, had already sold off quite a bit in a very short period of time. The other thing to make clear is there was this idea out there that the Fed could lower rates and still be on the track to 2% inflation. This idea of preemptive or optional cuts that it could take, that it would still be restrictive enough to bring inflation down, even if it cut by 25 or 50 or 75 basis points. That's the idea that's fading away now, Melissa.
Steve, it's Karen. Thanks for being on. I always come back to the question of what do you think the Fed wants real interest rates to be? And now, with the rates having moved, is there enough room to maybe still accommodate that?
Well, first of all, Karen, thank you and others on your panel for thinking the way economists think, which is in terms of real interest rates or the inflation-adjusted interest rates, because that makes it easier to it's a better way to understand the Federal Reserve. What we know is they raised their real or their neutral rate in the last meeting by a tenth. But there is talk out there that maybe that real rate of 3% minus, for example, their 2% goal of inflation is actually a bit higher than that. So they still think they have a ways to go. But remember, Powell is not an economist. He's a lawyer. And he looks at economists debating about neutral interest rates. And I don't know if he laughs, but he maybe scoffs a little bit. He thinks it's an exercise in theoretical academic economics that he doesn't have much patience for. His idea is we'll see the right real rate or the right neutral rate, you know, by the way the economy acts. And what we're hearing from Powell now is the economy ain't acting in a way that the Fed is necessarily too restrictive.
Steve, thank you. Nice to see you.
Pleasure.
Steve Leisman. So how do you think this plays out in terms of the market? Do you think there's a delayed reaction? Because oftentimes we do have delayed reactions to Fed speak.
I think we're delayed in waiting for earnings and earnings guidance, more importantly. You've said this a couple times this week, Karen, already. Like, you know, Q1's baked in the cake, okay? And we know that, you know, estimates usually come down into the quarter and then companies have a higher beat rate. And if the banks, at least the money center banks, at least they're, like, you know, the visibility or the tone is similar across some of these other sectors that have been leading the way. Technology would be a big one. If there is any lack of visibility in some of the biggest leaders in technology, I think the S&P is going to quickly go from being down 4% to down 10%. But in my mind, that's probably a good thing if you think about it. Maybe estimates don't come down too much for the year in the face of, you know, higher oil, higher dollar, higher yields. These are all headwinds to corporate earnings, right? If you think about a lot of 2023, the ability to, for companies to pass through, you know what I mean, some of these price increases to customers, that gets harder and harder. You know, to me, earnings visibility is going to be the most important thing, and it really will determine if we finally have, you know, a 10% drawdown. We did have one last year, July to early October, and you saw this kind of spring sort of action that we had from there. I just think expectations, sentiment, everything got a bit too euphoric a couple weeks ago.
But in terms of the charts, you already predict that the S&P is entering the lower band of
a
channel.
So. Also, speaking of inflation, you know, if you look at the S&P adjusting for inflation, we've still not taken out our 2021 high. And so that's a factor in terms of what one's results really are in the asset class of equities. But yes, we're down 4%+. Once you go down 5%, it typically triggers more. And if you look at all 5% plus sell-offs in the history of the S&P, several hundred of them going back to 1920s, once you go down 5%, the median and mean is between 8 and 11%. I think that's a normal kind of thing that should be, it's long overdue.
All right, coming up, a luxury slowdown, a currency crush, and the dank details from a cannabis conference. LVMH's sales growth hits a snag, the yen hitting its lowest level against a dollar in 34 years, and all the sights, sounds, and smells from one of the industry's biggest cannabis conferences. Tim will lay out the dope details next. But first, we're watching United Airlines after our shares on the move after results. We'll bring you the numbers from that report next. Don't go anywhere. Fast Money's back in two.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We've got an earnings alert on United Airlines, a beat in the top and the bottom line, sending that stock higher in after hours. Let's get to Phil LeBeau, who's got all the details. Phil.
Melissa, sometimes there's a beat and sometimes there's a, whoa, that is way better than what the street was expecting. That's the case with United in the first quarter. A loss of 15 cents a share. The street was expecting a loss of 57 cents a share. We'll explain why, a bit of a divergence there. By the way, United taking a $200 million impact in the first quarter because of the MAX 9 grounding. Without that, United says it would have been a profitable first quarter. Revenue, better than expected at $12.54 billion. And here's the divergence between United and the analysts. Revenue per seat mile coming in an increase of 0.6%. That's better than many analysts were expecting. And cost per seat mile, excluding fuel, is lower than many analysts were expecting. That is going to be up about 4.7%. Finally, when you look at their EPS guidance for the second quarter, it's higher than many on Wall Street are expecting. They're expecting to earn $3.75 to $4.25 a share. The street going into this report at $3.76. So clearly that's probably likely to go higher following the conference call tomorrow. And the fleet news is the news that's getting a lot of attention after hours. Remember that for some time, United has said they were looking to get Airbus A321s because they're not going to have MAX 10s. Well, they've secured a lease deal for 35 of them. They'll start to enter into service starting next year and then in 2026. And they've cut down the number of narrow-body planes they expect to take delivery of. Beginning of this year, they expected to take delivery of 101 now because of the problems at Boeing. And also there's restricted capacity for production at Airbus as well. They're going to get 61 this year instead of 101. That means they're shifting their CapEx. A couple of final notes. They're converting some MAX 10s orders to MAX 9s, and they are also grounding the grounding impact again, $200 million. Don't forget, Melissa, tomorrow morning on Squawk Box, we're going to talk with Scott Kirby, not just about the better-than-expected report in the first quarter, but what's happening at Boeing, the search for a new CEO, whether or not they still have confidence in the Dreamliner, given the fact that we'll hear from the whistleblower tomorrow on Capitol Hill. Lots to talk about with Scott Kirby.
Look forward to that tomorrow morning. Phil, thank you. Phil LeBeau. Tim Seymour, much better than expected, and the bar was set so low, especially after they canceled that Investor Day meeting.
Again, I think this was much better than expected. The fact that they reiterated that 24 full year guide of 9 to 11 bucks a share, the street, I don't think, was expecting that. It's the first operating profit since for the March quarter since 2019, I believe. I think their international business was a bright spot. It was up 11.7%. Domestic was solid. So if you look at United as a massive underperformer to Delta, I think you're going to get more follow through here. Again, I think this is a huge relief. I also think their fuel costs were better. So in a higher environment where airlines are going to struggle, always struggle based on even just sentiment around fuel, I think this was a very, very strong number, not just strong.
Carter has a chart look.
Well, there's so many ways. It's all about your time frame. It's a trading chip. We know this stock, how many times has it been bankrupt? It's the same price it was since 2006. And think of this. Its market cap is $13 billion. Williams-Sonoma, they make spatulas and blenders, is bigger than that. It's just not an important company. You can make a trade, but it's not an investment. It's something else.
There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Designer decline. Luxury retail seeing a slowdown as LVMH posts slowing sales growth. How consumers holding out on handbags are impacting the space. Next. Plus, land of the rising sun. But the currency is a different story. The yen at 34-year lows against the dollar. The key level it's nearing and how regulators could get involved. You're watching Fast Money live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Louis Vuitton parent LVMH reporting a 2% drop in first quarter revenue, missing analyst estimates. The luxury retailer blaming an uncertain economy and geopolitical environment for the shortfall. The company saw weakness in its watch division, as well as a 12% drop in organic sales for wines and spirits. Yet shares rose 3% to end the day. Karen, this one is in your acronym.
It is. It's the L in Helm.
You were also
right
on the call today. So why do you
I was.
Move up?
It moved up because remember when Kering announced that terrible miss? They're going to miss by 20% of revenues. So that was, you know, just a terrible day in the luxury space. And so fears were maybe overblown here. Things, when you adjusted for currency, which had a 4% negative effect, they actually reported positive. And Cognac, which was terrible and worse than they thought for a long time, that was bottoming out. Sephora was strong. Another interesting part is the Chinese buyer, while not so strong in China, was actually strong abroad. So that's a very big, very big helpful thing for them. Japan was uniquely strong. Huge increase in Japan, 32% growth in Japan. A lot of that was the Chinese buyer going to Japan. So that was an interesting bright spot. Quiet Luxury also doing well. Which, do you remember
Quiet
the whole
luxury?
Yes, the whole succession thing, like the $400 baseball cap and the no labels, no nothing, but just.
That sounds like ripoff, not quiet luxury.
It's Loro Piana is the division that would be quiet luxury. So that was doing well. Watches were not doing well. That was sort of a not so bright spot at all. But given how bad it could have been, this was much better than feared.
Coming up, Japan nearing a key level, the yen falling to 34-year lows against the dollar. An intervention may follow. Everything you need to know about the currency concerns next. Plus, some fast movers catching our traders' eyes today. How UNH kept the Dow afloat while J&J tried to bring it down. More on those moves when Fast Money returns.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money Podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks closing mixed after Fed Chair Jerome Powell said there's been a lack of progress in reducing inflation. The Dow snapping a six-day losing streak. The S&P and NASDAQ both ending in the red. Shares of Live Nation lower today after reports the Justice Department may sue the company for antitrust violations, a story we brought to you yesterday. The stock seeing its worst day since last July. Gold higher again today. The metal up more than 16% this year, settling at a record for the 20th time this year. And Berkshire Hathaway lower today. That stock notching its seventh straight day of losses, its longest losing streak since 2018. And Bitcoin falling below $63,000 as the entire crypto space pulls back. The big Bitcoin halving expected to take place this Friday, which will reduce the amount of available Bitcoins in circulation. Have we seen the post-halving rallies that have happened historically happen beforehand, Dan?
Yeah, and again, there's two events that have happened in the last couple months, right? So the spot Bitcoin ETFs, that was a lot of excitement. It went from 40 to, well, you know, 75,000. It seemed like almost in a straight line over the last few months. And this event, which has obviously been telegraphed, no one knew exactly when it was going to be, it does create greater scarcity, right? So it'll be interesting to see how it trades, you know, after this sort of event. The one thing I'll just mention, and Peter Brookar mentioned this to me yesterday, and I thought it was really interesting, is that over the weekend, there's very few risk assets that trade 24/7. Right. This did trade, and it traded down when bombs started flying into Iran, which just tells you that there's something different about this $1.2 trillion risk asset compared to some others, that this is meant to be, you know, a store of value. It's supposed to do the things that gold does, and I just thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, Novogratz mentioned that this morning, too.
On Squawk and Runs? Yeah. Oh, nice.
Squawk box. Turning now to Japan, where the yen has hit a 34-year low despite recent moves by the Bank of Japan to help boost the currency today. The country's finance minister said he is watching the moves and will provide a, quote, thorough response as needed. But our next guest says Japan is at DEFCON 3 when it comes to JPY intervention. Joining us now, BK Asset Management's Kathy Lean to explain what is happening and what to be aware of. Kathy, great to see you. Verbal jawboning doesn't seem to work. So what next?
You're right. I mean, verbal jawboning is basically something the market is anticipating. They want to see less talk and more action because, you know, as I said, the Japanese intervention risk is at DEFCON 3. But, you know, investors are not seeing any type of rate checking from the central bank. I think the one problem that we have right now is that when they intervened back in September, October 2022, the environment was very different. The one-month implied volatilities in the Japanese yen at the time was around 13 to 17%. Right now, the one-month implied volatility is closer to 9%. So the Japanese, who have been calling the move, you know, one-sided, disorderly, aren't necessarily seeing that immense amount of volatility that they saw back in 2002 that really pushed them to the edge of intervention. At the same time, this is really a dollar story, Melissa. And you know, if they intervene, they're fighting against the winds of the market because U.S. data has been very good. And the main reason why dollar yen shot to these 34-year highs, even though it had been an uptrend since the beginning of the year, is because we had that new leg higher in U.S. yields. You couple that with the Fed, you know, looking at a delayed interest rate cut, and all of that is really driving the dollar portion of the yen higher. So intervening at a time when we have yields going up in the U.S. and not going down will make it, you know, it a very difficult effort for the Bank of Japan and the Ministry of Japanese government in general. So it's, you know, they don't necessarily have the right environment that they're looking for to intervene, but you know, we're getting close to those levels where they really are going to be pushed to action. Otherwise, the market's going to push them into action.
Can you connect the dots for us in terms of the impact ultimately if there is intervention on U.S. rates, Japanese being the biggest holder of U.S. treasuries, and they're facing bigger energy bills at this point? They import, what, 90%+ of their energy into the country.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if they came into the market and they intervened, given that they're such large holders of U.S. treasuries, by intervening into the market, they're basically, you know, effectively need to sell treasuries and buy back the Japanese yen, which, you know, could affect, you know, U.S. interest rates in a way that they don't want to. Also, by selling U.S. dollars, that could also cause, you know, inflation to rise because a weaker dollar is inflationary. Now, you know, that is one of the main reasons why I don't think we're going to get coordinated intervention. tension. The Japanese currency spokesman has been teasing the contact he's having with international central banks. But I don't think this is the right environment for them to come into, because they're, you know, basically trying their best to keep that inflation level as, you know, going in the right direction. But at the end of the day, Melissa, I think it's important to realize that even if the Bank of Japan, Ministry of Finance come in, the intervention rarely is lasting in the market unless it's coordinated. And we've seen this time and time again. So I think, you know, it's going to be a futile effort on their part. I think we're going to end up seeing a situation where even if they intervene, dollar yen is going to fall sharply for sure. But you're going to see a lot of buyers come back into the markets.
Kathy, great to see you. Thanks. Kathy Lean. Carter here has got some charts on JPY. So what are you seeing?
Yeah, let's look at it. Well, two charts and they're identical with different lines. The first one, what you'll see here is that we moved above, this is going back to 1970. We have finally moved above that downtrend line, which is, of course, weakness in the yen. And ultimately, let's draw lines a different way. I think we're headed to 175. Now, obviously, the question is, do they intervene before that, or is intervention even effective? We shall see. But my hunch is there's more to come of what we've seen of late.
175. Tim, what does that do to your calculus in terms of investing there?
Well, it makes Japanese equities more interesting. Japanese exporters, I mean, for sure. Probably Japanese banks, who I think we're going to suffer also in at least some of the higher rate environment. But, you know, the yen carry trade, which is essentially borrowing, selling yen and investing in dollars, have only become more extreme as rates have disproportionately gone higher in the U.S. So there is more pressure on this. Kathy pointed out intervention doesn't work. And if anything, central bank differentials now really support the Fed perversely. Again, that's part of the reason why the dollar's going higher.
All right. Coming up, a pair of fast movers, United Health and Johnson & Johnson, moving in opposite directions after reporting some big earnings numbers before the bell. What investors liked, what they didn't, that's next. Plus, Goldman Sachs betting big on sports betting. DraftKings jumping on a huge call from those analysts today. The reasons behind this wager right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Insurance giant United Health surging today on a blowout earnings report before the bell, adding 152 points to the Dow and single-handedly lifting the index into the green today. The company beating on the top and the bottom line, affirming strong full-year EPS guidance. United Health revenues for the quarter coming in at just under $100 billion after the impact of the company's recent cyber attack, an increase of nearly 9% from the same period last year. Also, medical loss ratio, when you back out the impact from that cyber attack, was also below what analysts had been expecting, specifically what Jared Holtz yesterday of Mizuho had outlined at 84%. So, Karen, what does this do in terms of the expectations for the rest of the industry? We did see the likes of a Humana up sharply today on the back of this.
Right. So, I mean, obviously it's good when you have someone like United Health doing well, but I think for United Health, it was a big sigh of relief. Nothing terrible happened, and the stock had been really shellacked in the last few months. So, sort of somewhat of a relief rally, as well as, you know, deserved that they stuck by their guidance. So that was good. They could have easily changed it. So things are getting back to, some of them are back above where they're trading when we got that bad news on reimbursement. And the whole space was down like 5%. So relieved.
United is the U in Carter's plug trade.
Godlike.
Still godlike?
Still godlike. Well, as you said, it's been shellacked. And also, it's so funny, you know, if you're a journalist can start their story anyway. Today, it's that it surged. But it's what it really is, you could start your headline like this. Instead of being down 11% from April 1st, it's now down only 4%. You could start your story however you want. But the point is, this has been under a lot of pressure. This is a relief rally, and at least it happened up, not down, because then it would have really sunk the ship and made this under pressure that would have to be considered. Maybe it's not godlike. It's the safe.
But it is still godlike in your
sure.
view.
Yeah.
For sure. Okay. All right. Meantime, Johnson & Johnson dropping despite reporting an earnings beat and inline revenue. The healthcare company also adjusting full-year guidance to just slightly below the top end of what analysts were expecting. The company did see sales of medical devices surge as demand for non-urgent surgeries grew, and that's sort of in line in terms of what we've been hearing from the insurers, Tim, in terms of utilization rates and procedures getting done.
MedTech was very strong, and if you look at their innovative medicine division, effectively 65% of their sales, roughly, it's very strong. Orthopedic backlogs for old guys like me, getting weird kind of things, knees and shoulders done. I mean, there's a lot of demand for that. The big story, the financial performance of the company was fine. And investors have to think about this as a total return type investment, solid dividend, and I think a pretty conservative company. All things said, the overhang from the talc litigation is really what's holding the stock back. I think any type of settlement is probably good news. I think the market has priced a lot of this in, and we had some news, whatever, a few weeks ago that maybe there's a chance for them to re-argue their case on correlations. Maybe the best thing for the company is just to keep moving forward. So I think there's an opportunity in the stock. I'm comfortable waiting for that opportunity, but this has been a stock that's done nothing for 5 years.
It's interesting. So just, this is a $350 billion market cap company. UNH is a pretty sizable one, $500 billion. Look at Apple at $2.6 trillion. There's a bunch of really big stocks in the market that act really badly. When you see a stock like Johnson & Johnson making new 52-week lows with the S&P only down 4% from its highs, I'm just saying it could be stock-specific. I get it. But there's a lot of stocks that are having lots of stock-specific stories. You put them together and you probably have more of a downdraft.
Coming up, betting on a winner, a big call on DraftKings, why analysts are wagering on the name. Could it be good parlay for your portfolio? We have the details next. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Let's get to our call of the day. DraftKings popping on a bullish call from Goldman Sachs, closing the day up more than 2.7%. Analysts saying they expect continued growth in the states where gambling is legal and an additional benefit as more states grant approval. DraftKings getting a $60 price target, about 33% higher from here. How does that chart look, Carter?
I mean, this is the definition of an uptrend, meaning and not ever extended. Every time it gets a little ahead of itself, it checks back. It has a lilting sort of give back, a drawdown that sets it up to make a new intermediate high. I would say it's the definition of stay long, be long. What's not to like?
Meantime, things are heating up in Miami as one of the industry's biggest cannabis conferences kicks off today. Our own Tim Seymour, in-house cannabis expert, is dialing in from the event. So what's the buzz there at the conference, Tim?
Puns aplenty, and certainly I think excitement aplenty for an industry that probably tries to control its emotions vis-a-vis how you've had headlines over the last 5 years, and even more so that have often been dashed. But the expectation is that we had a clarification from the White House yesterday in terms of really just restating what they've said, which is that they've had the Health and Human Services Agency recommended the FDA through a very long report by the FDA with a lot of medical proof that they think cannabis should be rescheduled. That doesn't require legislation. So those are the those are the things that I think there can be reasonable expectations on, even in a world where there's a political cycle probably that if they don't get it done sometime in the next few months, it probably gets lost in the Biden administration's need to focus on everything else. There's a view that this is an important issue for Biden, and there's an issue that this is something that really isn't that big of a give on the other side. But again, this is Biden's ability to probably control this. I think overall, though, I sat on the global economy of cannabis, where we just had big news out of Germany. There's certainly expectations. There's a number of the American producers that have exposure in that part of the world. So I think an industry that has not a ton of institutional investment, and that alone would be something to get this industry going, is pretty excited by fundamentals bottom up.
All right. Up next, final trades. Welcome back to Fast Money. Another record for women's basketball. Last night's WNBA draft drawing nearly 2.5 million viewers, shattering the previous record of 600,000 set 20 years ago. You know what is not setting records, though? The salaries of the players. Check out the rookie contract of the number one pick, Caitlin Clark, a four-year deal worth just $328,000. Her first year salary, a paltry $76,000. In contrast, last year's number one pick in the NBA signed a rookie deal worth $55 million. That's a huge difference, Karen.
Yes, it is. I mean, part of the media rights. This is the whole thing that the league can capitalize on. They have new media right negotiation coming up for the next year. that will be dramatically different than the $60 million they have now. So those salaries will go up.
Time for the final trade. Tim.
Another spirits company, Diageo, 35% off its highs. It's interesting here.
CBW.
Biotech was a great winner and sold off almost 20% XBI for a bounce.
Karen.
Yes, Etsy off its lows. I think we could see some growth in GMV there.
Dan.
Why don't you offer Caitlin 150 grand to come work for you next year?
She'd much rather do
double
that.
It up. All right. AXP, I'd be a seller into the print Friday.
Thanks for watching Fast Money. See you tomorrow morning on Squawk Box. Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/fastmoneydisclaimer.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.